Alright, we are recording.
Alright, call to order for the meeting, Public Workshop, North Bend Planning Commission, Thursday, July 26th, City Hall. Minutes, June 28th, 2012, Planning Commission meeting. Do you have a motion?
To approve the minutes.
Second?
Second.
Discussion? Adds, changes? All in favor? Motion carries. Signed copy for that. Thank you. Oh, but it's on the floor. That one's gone. Public comment on non-agenda items. We do have some folks here. Are you here for the workshop? I mean, non-agenda. Okay, great. Then we'll move right on. Energy and Sustainability Workshop. This is the fourth in the series. Tonight's conversation is around greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. Guest speaker, Dr. Richard Gammon. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And then we'll do some Q&A and review consideration draft policies. So, Mike, you want, I'm sure you're going to want to tee it up, and I'm assuming we want to handle this as the open workshop as we have before with the public, right?
Yeah, so if that's all right, if we can just invite questions during the presentation.
Of course.
And so if we'll do that, but I will ask members of the audience, if the first time you speak, if you give your name and address so we can have for the release here. Appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah, well, I want to thank Dr. Richard Gammon for coming out tonight. Dr. Gammon is an adjunct professor of chemistry and oceanography, professor of chemistry and oceanography and adjunct professor of climatology. From the University of Washington.
Emeritus,
yeah. And just wanted to have a chance to present what the information is that the science recognized by the U.S. and international bodies on climate change. What we choose to do with that then as a local jurisdiction is up to us, but I just wanted to be able to present the information out there for the benefit of the Planning Commission and the public. And so I'll turn it over to Professor Gammon to present, and then following that, we'll go into, I'll switch computers and PowerPoints, and we'll go into some discussion on what is North Bend doing to address some of the local impacts of climate change, what are we doing with regard to our policies on greenhouse gas emissions, and just invite questions and discussion. I'll turn it over to Dr. Gammon.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Pleased to be here. First time I've spoken to this group, although I have spoken around the state over the last few decades, really, in Natchez and all around, and especially in Western Washington. I've been engaged in climate research and climate change communication for 30 or 40 years, a long time. I was a co-author on the first international report on the carbon cycle, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which is sort of the international group puts us together. The first report was in 1990, and I had been director of the Carbon Dioxide Measurement Program for the U.S. government in Boulder, Colorado in the early 80s. And really got interested in climate change. I had my finger on the pulse of the planet. The data coming in from Barrow in the South Pole was really, really exciting science to be good. Later, I came to the University of Washington and was teaching in the chemistry department. All their students are have to take freshman chemistry before they go to med school. I taught 600 one quarter. It's amazing. Anyway, I would also work some climate change into those lectures. But really, my heart is in climate science communication with the general public, with school groups, business groups, et cetera, church groups. And so, although I'm retired, I still teach part-time at the university and am actively involved in climate change to local audiences. So I'm really happy to have a chance to talk to you. I'm going to speak for about 30, 35 minutes and then have time for questions after that. But please stop me at any point. The focus of the talk, I have to say, I know that you're doing really granular things. You're looking right here at this city, this region, and what we need to do to create a more robust and sustainable society here. My view is going to be sort of the 30,000-foot view, mainly the global perspective, quite a bit on the U.S., and including strange weather events that have happened in the last year or two in the U.S., and does that, quote, prove global warming or not? So I'm taking the view, this is a talk that you would give to a skeptical friend of yours, uncle. I have a brother who's a petroleum engineer in Houston. We hardly can't talk about this subject. So it has become politicized. I don't think the science is politicized. I think the science is subjective, evidence-based. And whatever your political views are, start with reality. And you have a chance to get a reasonable policy. So this is reality-based, objective science. We can talk about what I think. I'm not a policy person. I'm not an economist. I'm really a climate change scientist. But this is what I think we know. So here we go. How do I form?
Page down.
Okay, well, this happened in today's New York Times. And we're in a terrible drought. 80% of the corn crop is damaged, not lost, but damaged. If it doesn't, if the tassels don't work at the right time, you won't get the kernels. And the soy is a little bit more robust to drought, but we're in a bad situation. And the price for soy and corn has already gone up 50%. And we export a lot of grains, not just chicken feed. It's all around the world. As this drought continues and expands, it's now equal to the worst drought in the historical record, which was Dust Bowl summer of 1934.
Do we have any climate data from 1934?
Yeah,
we do.
We have some. And you can reconstruct what's called the Palmer Drought Index, which was really established 20 years ago, but you can work backwards using the indices, the formulas in that. And sort of reconstruct. I'll show you, it was in the New York Times, a map of the drought extent for the last 120 years. We'll see this whole map, and we'll see how 2012 compares with 1955 and 1934. Page down? Or what? This one. Sorry. What else is happening? This is not the first time, but Siberia is burning again. They don't have smoke either there. They don't put it out. And that smoke comes over us. You know, we had some nice sunsets a week or so ago. Not very far from Siberia to here, around the Great Circle Route. So some of the things that are happening in Russia, and certainly in China. Coal burn in China sends mercury and ozone to the Cascades. So we are living in one world. A week or so ago, another huge chunk of ice broke off the Piedmont Glacier, which is one of the main outlet glaciers on the Greenland ice cap. This one is, that rock is, that piece of ice is twice the size of Manhattan. And a few years ago, another larger piece, four times the size of Manhattan, broke off. Does that immediately cause sea level rise? No, not if it's already floating. Does this happen often? Is it a concern? Will it accelerate the glacier after this? Maybe. We don't know.
So, again, the piece that broke off is that?
That one.
That one. Yeah.
That's twice the size of Manhattan.
So everything in front of it's pretty good size, too.
Yeah. And just this week, for the first time in 150 years, going by the ice core records, the entire surface of the Greenland ice cap melted. That means the snow right on top, out above freezing. And that hasn't happened in 150 years. Normally it looks like this, it's melting around the edges. But a lot of warm air came up in mid-July, and there was melting even on the summit, which is 3 kilometers, so 10,000 feet.
Okay, and on that slide, I just happened to see the news coverage on that particular report just afternoon. And there were some scientists in Greenland that do ice core samples, and they're reporting that this is a 150-year cyclical event. So
it does happen. You're not saying this is due to climate change.
I mean, I just felt that was a noteworthy thing.
That's right.
This isn't the first time that this has happened.
No, it isn't. First time in 150 years. We can look in the ice core record and see that this is something cyclical. It doesn't mean that this isn't completely natural. We do know that the melting around Greenland is accelerating, and that the ice loss from Greenland, we can measure from satellites, is a couple hundred billion tons of water equivalent per year.
What is the cycle? It's cyclical.
What causes the 150-year cycle?
Well, is it every 150 years? Is that?
I only know the report. I haven't seen the ice core data.
Okay.
What has happened?
Like 9 years ago, 1,000 years ago.
How far back can you look with Greenland? You can only look back about 120,000 years. You go that far down and you get bedrock. So the last interglacial, that was warm like it is now, was about 120,000 years ago. And below that, there's no data. If you want to go further back, you have to go to Antarctica.
And the reason why I ask is that if there is a cycle, perhaps there were other catastrophic events at that time, volcanoes, who knows, that maybe have contributed to that.
Volcanism would show in the ice. If it was known in the volcano, you'd see that in the ice. So I don't know what the cause of the cyclical cycle is. But it's interesting that suddenly, very quickly, within a week, there was melting all over the surface of Greenland. So this is the elevator message, you have 2 minutes with your skeptical uncle in the car. One, climate change is real, it's happening now. Two, we are causing most of the change. That doesn't mean people maybe have something to do with it. No, most, more than half, due to human activity. Three, climate scientists are not arguing. They agree on this. They agree on points 1 and 2.
There is no scientific debate. 4, the projected impacts are predicted to be very bad for people and for nature. How bad? Depends upon how much carbon dioxide we put up. 5, there is hope to avoid the worst if we start to act now. Those are the 5 points.
Yes. Can I just ask a couple of questions?
It's just about, we're not going to get a debate now. We're going to have time after the presentation. Go ahead. Clarification is fine.
You've reported 97%.
Yeah, right.
Is there a survey?
Yeah, there was a survey of climate scientists.
So the American Geological Survey?
American Geophysical Union, I can give you the reference for that. Yeah, I think it's a paper that appeared in Science. But basically, a survey of the climate scientists who actually work on this topic overwhelmingly agree.
I'd like to come back to that.
Yeah, okay, we'll come back.
Further discussion.
All right. Coles is great cartoonist. After a comprehensive review of the climate science, we have concluded that climate change is 99.5% certain, not 100% as previously stated. Aha, I knew it. It follows its own hopes. So, what is there in science which is 100% certain? The Higgs boson is now 99.9999. They got 6 sigma or something like that before they realized they said that they had discovered this particle. But almost nothing in science is 100%. Science is provisional truth. It's always going to be overthrown. We're always going to learn new things. And what public policy, local to national to international, is ever done with 100% certainty? What insurance do you buy with 100% certainty? Did your house burn down this year? Did your car wreck? No. You wasted your money, right? You buy insurance. We need to be buying insurance against climate change. How do we know that the world is warming? Temperatures are going up in the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, the lower atmosphere. Temperature of the ocean is going up. Sea ice is retreating. Ocean heat content is increasing and measured. Sea level is increasing. Measured humidity is going up. Measured temperature over land is going up. Snow cover is going down. Glaciers going down. All measured, as predicted by climate change. Here's the CO2 record, the famous Keeling record, started in 1958 by David Keeling at Scripps. I had the good fortune to be responsible for the U.S. government program in the early 1980s, so I got to go to the mountain with Dave, and my job was to convince Dave Keeling that the U.S. government could take this over and make the measurement as well as he could, because we know that he's mortal. He died a couple years ago. And so both records are still running at Mauna Loa. You can go to the Big Island and go up on the mountain, Mauna Kea, Mauna Loa, and sign the guest book and see this record. The value, when I was in charge of the network, was about 340, and it was going up about 1 part per million per year. Now the value is over 392 parts per million, and it's increasing 2 or 2.5 parts per million per year. So it's accelerating. Our only hope is to bend this curve over. It's not going to, actually, to have it go flat would be zero emissions for the world. That's not going to happen, not anytime soon. But this is the problem. Do we know this is due to human activity? Yes, absolutely. Do we know what sort of human activity? Yes, we do. Burning of fossil fuels and deforestation, slash and burn. How do we know that? Carbon-13 and carbon-14, your isotopes tell us. Fossil fuel is dead, it has no carbon-14 radioactivity. Your body is radioactive with carbon-14. Every living thing has radioactive carbon in it. When you die, then that starts to decay. So, and plants have a certain ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 as well. So we can tell using carbon-13 and carbon-14 that we're responsible for the increase. It's primarily fossil fuel burning. And a secondary effect, 10-15%, is tropical deforestation, slash and burn.
Professor, you talked about 1974. Is that the mark change in color there?
That's probably when the Scripps record was. Before this time, there was no government record. Both records could continue here, but I'm only showing the NOAA record, the government record, but the Keeling record would be right on top of it. You couldn't see the difference.
So the red indicates government today.
Yeah, well, you know, he wouldn't like to say that. He would like to say that he let us make measurements in parallel to his, and they agreed. His son continues the measurements. His son is professor of Scripps now. Well, it's not a new problem. Not a new problem at all. More than 200 years ago, the idea that the heat balance of the Earth was a greenhouse effect was established by Joseph Fourier. 150 years ago, people say, well, how do you know that CO2 actually traps heat? Well, by direct laboratory measurement, 150 years ago, John Tyndall did this in the lab and showed it in a demonstration. You can show that CO2 traps heat, acts as a greenhouse gas. And then about 100 years ago, it cost him his marriage, Arrhenius took a year, hand calculations, no computers, to calculate the entire albedo and temperature structure of the Earth and how it would change if we double CO2. His prediction? The Earth would warm by 5 or 6 degrees C. He's only off by about a factor of 2.
The best computer models today say 3 or 4 degrees C for double CO2. These aren't great. In Sweden, he said, we're going to live in a warmer climate in the future. We just vaporize the coal mines. It's all going to be good. Oops, wrong one. Okay, this is the global surface temperature data anomaly, the departure from climatology for last year. We don't have 2012 because it's not over yet. A couple things to notice about the pattern. The warming is greater at high latitude. That's why Greenland's melting and why we're losing the Arctic sea ice. Warming is greater at high latitude than toward the equator. The warming is greater over the land than over the ocean. Doesn't show here, but the warming is greater in winter than in summer. The warming is greater at night than during the day. All predicted by climate change models, all observed. If this were due to solar, it wouldn't be that way. You'd have warming in the day, not at night. You wouldn't have warming in the winter. So all of the predictions, the observations of the web, the pattern, the fingerprint of the warming tells us that greenhouse gases are responsible for the imbalance. Here's the actual surface temperature record. This is this record from NASA. And the warmest year was not 1998. It has not been cooler since 1998. It continued to warm. 2005 was the warmest year until we had 2010, which is the warmest year in the Northern Hemisphere surface temperature record.
What does the science community feel about the accuracy quality of temperature records back into the 1800s?
Well, it gets less certain as you go back. That's right. I have other figures that sort of get a fuzz on this. I would think the global data from 1880 or so, even to World War II, probably was uncertain by several tenths of a degree C. Beyond the IGY 1958, the data gets progressively better. The number of observing stations increases, and after about 1970 or 75, we have satellite data. Collaboration.
Sure. But even in, even back into the 1800s, the data points there are based on global positioning.
Global.
Not just
right.
A few
locations. Before 1880, we figured there were not enough stations globally to make a global average, so they don't do it. You have central England back to 1300, but you can't use that as global. So, yes, it's still warming. There was warming in the first part of the century, up to about 1930 or 35. Partly natural, partly solar. And then there was a period of no warming from the end of World War II until about 1970 or 75. Then the 80s were warmer than the 70s. The 90s were warmer than the 80s. The 2000s were warmer than the 90s. And we continue this. So the decadal average of warming continues up. There is no combination of natural forcing, solar, volcanoes, El Nino, whatever. There's no combination of natural forcing that explains this. Only greenhouse gases. That's all. So, what do we make of this? This is a kind of a busy graph, but it's really easy. Just look at the curves. This is sort of the bell-shaped curve that would be like the distribution of temperature. And if the time is changing, one way it might change is that the bell-shaped curve is preserved. It all just sort of moves over to the right. The average warming is the average Earth temperature is warmer, but the variability is the same. So then it just kind of moves over to the right. What does that mean? Fewer cold periods, more hot periods. That's one possibility. The bell-shaped curve, the shape is preserved, it just moves over to a higher mean. Another possibility, no change in the average temperature, but the bell-shaped curve gets fatter in the wings. More extremes cold, more extremes hot, but the average, say, temperature doesn't change. Or some combination of these. Maybe the thing moves over to the right to average hotter temperatures, and it gets broader, hotter and more variable. That's our world. That's where we are. That's what the data show. That's what the next slide will show. So this is Jim Hansen's data, looking at Northern Hemisphere summer temperatures. And normal distribution, the Gaussian curve is the lack of it here. And it fits amazingly well for the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s. The red, the orange, and the green curves all lie on this bell-shaped Gaussian curve. And then what happens? Look at the 80s. Oops, slipping out to the high side. Look at the 90s. A little further. Look at this decade. It moves to the right by a full standard deviation, and the wings are way out there. The wings are 2 or 3 standard deviations out. What does that mean? That means that the once in a 100-year flood, storm, drought comes every 10 years. And the 10-year storm comes every year. That's what it means. So it's hotter on the average, and the extremes are greater. Fewer extreme cold events, more extreme warm events, and more variability. That's our world. Welcome to the rest of your life. So here's a pattern of warming in winter. This is a 30-year average. 30 years becomes climate. 1 year is weather. Like, you say, when am I going to die? I don't know. That's weather. What's the average age of a white male? Life expectancy. Oh, I can tell you that. 81 years, it's 82 years, whatever it is. That's climate. That's the difference between climate and weather. Individual versus statistical. So over a long period of time, this is a 30-year average, saying 1995 compared to 1985, the 30-year average. And you can see that the middle of our country is warming up in the wintertime. Ask the farmers up there. They have a different growing season.
Similar data available for Canada?
That was a U.S. study, but yeah, the people at University of Victoria, Professor Weaver, has done a very good book and very good study of climatology changes for Canada. If there was random variation in hot and cold years, it'd be like throwing a dice, right? 50-50, some years warm, some years cold. And so the ratio of extreme record-setting heat and record-setting cold would be 1-to-1. And it was about 1-to-1 in the 50s. A little bit less than 1-to-1 in the 60s and 70s. They were on average a little colder than warm. And then back in the 80s, it was almost 1-to-1. In the 90s, it was 1.4-to-1. In this decade, it was 2-to-1. And this year, it was 10-to-1, hot versus cold. So it's not random changes. It's not just as many cold records as hot records.
These are, again, average records, correct? Averages of...
How do I go back? These are record temperatures for cities or regions. Okay, these are like if Chicago reports a record hot month or week, that would count as a record temperature. So it's just comparing the reported meteorological record high temperatures versus record low temperatures.
U.S. states.
U.S. U.S.
cities.
I think cities could be states. I should check on that. And so, again, here's one of the references, Jerry Neal et al. from NOAA. Sort of saying it was 50-50, it would be as many highs as lows, and the 50s were about like that. But 2009, notice, more hot than cold. 2010, many more hot years than cold records. 2011, even more. And so far, 2012, only high temperature records, almost no low temperature records. Dramatic difference. Now, not all, next year is probably not going to look like that, but it's not going to go back to 1-to-1 either. It's going to be 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, something like that. We're on our way to a hotter, more variable world. And here are some of the thousands. More than 3,000 temperature records were set in the month of June for the United States. Staggeringly higher, nearly degrees higher than any temperature ever seen. May was the warmest temperature in the Northern Hemisphere ever. And January, February, March, April, May, June is the warmest six-month period for the United States since records began in 1895. And extreme events go along with that. So this is sort of looking at 20 or 30 years of extreme events, whether they're meteorological storms or floods or droughts or wildfires. And so these extreme events are also increasing. This is 2011. You remember this because there was a tremendous number of hurricanes, tornadoes. Hurricane Irene wrecked the East Coast. Terrible droughts and flooding, terrible droughts and fires in New Mexico and Texas. It was the hottest summer ever in Texas and Oklahoma, and the worst forest fires in New Mexico and Texas, if you remember. Texas lost the cotton crop, and we'll see what happens to the corn crop this year further north. And here's the drought index last July. You can see what happened in West Texas and in Oklahoma. Here's the heat wave, again. Tremendous. I have a brother, again, as I said, in Houston. Not up here. It's cool for us, right?
Too cool.
And then this is kind of a new thing. I mean, they have this in the Middle East, right? But we didn't have this. It's starting to happen now. And not just last year, it's happening again this year.
Yeah, oh. I used to live in Phoenix for 5 years.
Did you live to one of those?
Yeah, all the time. We always have them.
It's what you're showing here is an increased frequency, not a new occurrence since, say, the
right.
30s, right?
Right. I don't know the history of these dust storms in Phoenix over decades. I don't know the data.
Yeah, I don't know the data. I just know we lived there for 2002 to 2008, and it was an amazing experience. I mean, it's just amazing. This huge wall, you can't even fathom the size of it, of dust coming in, the sandblasting and everything. You can't see anything, and then a thunderstorm comes in after it. It's like you get sandblasted, and then there's pressure hose.
Yeah.
Just insane.
I went to Washington State University, and
back in the late 70s, the same circumstances occurred, at least a half a dozen times, you know, with the cardiac pain. So this isn't a particular occurrence, really.
No, we're talking about the frequency and severity more. Yeah. Certainly during the Dust Bowl years in the 30s, when people, you know, rain follows the plow, right? You break open the sod, wind comes, no wind rakes. Okies, this was something that was partly natural, that is the heat, drought of that time, but partly made worse by farming practices. Here's the fire scar in Texas. It was a horrible fire. Killed a lot of people, they had to try to get out of there as fast as they could. Now this year, I have a daughter, a niece, who lives up here near the Air Force Academy, just up here in Monument. And we called Sherry and she said, yeah, they told us, pack the car, be ready to go. This fire was stopped before the Air Force Academy, but it burned hundreds of homes. It was a terrifying fire. It was the most dangerous and destructive fire in the history of Colorado. And New Mexico also had its worst fire ever, and Arizona its worst fire ever. So why are there more fires now in the West? Well, again, we're loading the dust. What's happening? Warmer, less snow, beetle-peeled forests, put all that together, and you're going to have more extreme fire conditions. I drove through Estes Park for a wedding last summer, and it's all sort of rust-colored dead trees. Almost all of Estes Park is beetle-peeled.
Is it the breadth of forest acreage burning period, or in relationship to where development is?
No, the total acreage burning is up. Total acreage burned for years up, and the Forest Service is not dedicating enough resources to fighting this. Of course, you want to protect people's homes, and they build their homes on the forest-grassland interface in a very fire-prone area. So a lot of resources go to protecting people's houses there, but the actual acreage burned is increasing.
Dr. Gamble, yeah. A few years ago, there was another huge fire in Colorado, and I thought there was a change to some of the forestry practices, where they were going to manage the forest and thin them out a little bit better. Do you know if this forest was managed at all or not?
I don't know. I'm not even sure what caused this fire. Could be lightning strikes, could have been a person. I think that if you say, we're going to go manage the Estes National Park, you have to cut down all the forest, because basically all the trees are dead.
And so you made reference to a beetle, and what has brought about the beetles, like what we have here with our hemlocks, there's a beetle that's coming because of the warmer temperatures.
Yes. What they can do, I mean, there's spruce budworm, there's pine bark beetle, there are a number of them, but they like warmer winters, and they can get two families out instead of one family in a warm summer. And unless it's a hard frost, they're not dead. And so the new head of the College of Forest, the College of the Environment at the University of Washington is a forester. And she said, what we need to plan for in the West is early succession forest. That is, we're going to basically lose most of the forest in the West and kind of start over. Has this happened naturally? Well, maybe it did. But it's a long time ago. Nothing to be with it.
So I wonder if you can trace a lot of this beetle migrations from warmer climates. Montana is pretty much devastated.
Yeah.
Is that
in D.C.
also?
Yeah.
Well, in relation to the pine bark beetle, I mean, that's a huge problem in the South.
Yeah.
It has been, but it's more attributed to monoculture than it is to the, I mean, obviously the warmth down there is very helpful for the beetles all around, but their ability to spread is due to the monoculture.
Yeah. In Colorado, I'm told that there's not a single mature large pole pine left. Okay. And that's not because of my question. So here's some of the smoke from the fires. This is the aerosol count, which is the soot and the smoke from the fires. And you can sort of see that the fires, there were fires in Utah as well, as well as the ones in Colorado and New Mexico.
What besides CO2 makes up the smoke?
CO2 is not visible here. This is particles. Some micron particles that scatter light, to scatter visible light.
How small?
Below a micron, the size of the wavelength of light. Respirable particles, bad for you. In 2011, of course, we had a horrible series of tornadoes. We had some very early this year as well, but I think 2011 was worse in terms of damage and number of people killed. So here was March of this year. People said, wow, it's like summer already. They said summer came in March. And all the trees up here, they've got the cherry trees and others, people got their corn in early. They said, boy, we're going to have a great growing season. It's going to be a record crop, corn crop. But, you know, then it turned cold. And they lost all the cherries. There's no cherries here. Our cherry crop will be sold around the country because they lost all the cherries. So here's the temperature anomaly in June. And you can sort of see that, that they pulled off back here, and now this is the warmth of the corn belt. And it's really...
What's the variation that is used to judge the anomaly?
Let me go back. Hey, what's the page? Can I go back?
Yeah, up here.
Up here. Here it is. So the no change, that is, the no temperature is the same as the 30-year average would be the white.
Okay. So it's judged against the 30-year average.
Yeah, against
so
the 30-year
any deviation
average.
From the average.
That's right. And so these colors look to me like as much as 7, 8, 9 degrees centigrade, double that for Fahrenheit, just 20 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Okay?
It's a lot.
And here's a drought, one of the latest drought monitors put out by NOAA. And basically, now more than two-thirds of the U.S. is in some degree of drought. And some areas are in extreme drought. Has this happened before? Yeah, maybe, but maybe once in 1930. Further back, we have no data more than 120 years back. So here's the outlook looking ahead for the next few months. The drought will continue, and the drought will spread. Some relief here in the far southwest, but most of the U.S. will remain in drought. And so I think that we're going to lose most of the corn crop and most of the soy crop.
Is there relief in the southwest due to the monsoon season?
Yes, I would assume so. Okay, this was in the New York Times, I think, last Sunday. And so you read this, this is like 1896, 1934 was the granddaddy. July 1934 was the worst drought in the United States. And here we are now. And this is already a little bit out of date. So this is the drought of 2012. And you can sort of see, scan with your eye, you'll find the drought in the first of the 50s. Let's see, 30, 40, 50. In the mid 55, 56, 57 was a pretty bad drought. But 34 was the worst, and we're coming up on that now. These dust storms continue. This is just one from Tempe this past month. Okay, take-home points. Climate change is real. It's happening now. We, humans, are causing most of the change. Climate scientists agree on this point. I should have called these people skeptics, not denialists. That would be a little bit more respectful, I guess. Because I'm a skeptic. What scientist of any kind is not a skeptic? Science is about skepticism. Show me the data. If I can prove you wrong, I will. Science is about skepticism. It's not about belief. Science is not a belief system. Climate change is not a belief system. It's about proving things. Here's the proof. Here's the Bible of climate science, the latest one. They come every 5 years. I helped write the 1990 report. And the next one will be about in 2013 or 14. They say, warming of the climate system is unequivocal. Now evidence of observations of increases in global average air, ocean temperature, widespread melting of snow and ice, rising global average sea temperature. The IPCC 2007 finds that it's, quote, very likely, and this is quantitative, they put numbers on this, 90 to 95% confidence, very likely, that emissions of heat-trapping gases from human activities have caused most of the observed increase in global average temperature. And say, well, you know, people maybe have something to do with it. No, it says we have caused most of the change. And this is very scientifically conservative. This is also from 5 years ago. And nothing that's happened since then has changed it. So here's likely, unlikely, very likely, less than likely, with the quantitative numbers underneath. We're over here. So I went in a bipartisan group to talk to Dave Freikert, who was running at some point for Congress. I went with the Republican for Environmental Protection. We sat down with Riker and we said, well, what's happened now? We've moved from the civil standard to the criminal standard of evidence. It's not balance of evidence. This is now beyond a reasonable doubt. He got it. And he's a law and order guy, right? And there continue to be updates on the science. This is one of the recent papers out of booklets out of the National Academy of Science, updating the science. Again, saying the same thing. Climate change is real, it's happening now, and it's largely due to human activity. This is a U.S. position, this is an international position. The science academies of all the countries of the world buy into this. They say the same thing. So if this is a conspiracy, it's a hell of a conspiracy. I like this one. Give me a second to take that in. I showed this in to like an old folks home in Issaquah.
And there was one old codger there, he said, "Dang, I hope I live to 2020.
So, I'm not going to dwell on this. These are just more indications of how we know that the warming is occurring. What we don't know is, if we double CO2, how warm is it going to get? Remember, Arrhenius got 5 or 6 degrees 100 years ago when he did the calculation by hand. Most of the best climate models now have the highest number about 3 degrees of warming centigrade, 6 degrees Fahrenheit, for double CO2. Are we going to double CO2? Almost certainly. We're already more than half the way there. The natural level is 280. We're already at 400. 550 is double CO2, with whatever climate's going to come with that. Notice the tail. There's a possibility that doubling CO2 would give us 5 degrees centigrade, 10 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a different climate than anything since human civilization began.
Dr. Gibb, yeah. I'm a simple guy, and is there an easy answer for what exactly does CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide do to cause the warming?
Yeah. I have a slide on that. Let me get to that.
I don't leave enough time for questions, and I'm probably running long already.
This is just a record of 400,000 years from ice cores at the South Pole, because the ice of Greenland stops about right here. The last time it was this warm, there was no ice on Greenland. It went down to bedrock. And the ocean, of course, was how much higher? 50, 100 feet higher. The ocean was a lot higher. Anyway, you can sort of see the cycle of the ice ages. Every 100,000 years, warm, and then cold, warm, and cold, warm, cold, warm, cold. And this is all of human history right here, the last 10,000 years. And this is a different scale. This is the last 100 years here, showing temperatures not changing much. CO2 is more than double, and the CO2, which in cold times is 200 parts per million, 0.02%. In warm times, the natural level was 280, and now we're at 395, now 392, and running away. So that's
so no measurements. So the first scale is averages, or
these are
recorded actuals.
Actual measurements of air bubbles trapped in the ice.
Right.
The temperature is a proxy using oxygen 18 and deuterium. So it's a proxy using isotopes. These are direct measurements of air bubbles trapped in ice and dated to that time. Okay. So no assumptions here. Direct measurements.
So what I was getting at is, so the spike for the current would not be found in any correlated data
as you can cut it, you wouldn't have seen it. There's no time in the last 400,000 years, and actually, we now think that these levels are so high that the last time that these levels were seen on Earth was probably several million years ago, before the cycle of the ice ages started. Here's a reconstruction of the surface temperature record. This is the famous hockey stick from man, but it's been reproduced by many other people. The gray area is the uncertainty. There were no thermometers back then, except maybe in England in 1200. So how did they do this? Well, boreholes, coral reefs, tree rings, and try to get a reconstruction for the northern hemisphere surface temperature. And the historical data is shown in red, and where are we now? We're up here somewhere. About 8 tenths of a degree centigrade above the average. And so for the last 1,000 years, and actually you can go back to the time of Jesus, another 1,000 years, and you get the same thing. So there's nothing in the last 2,000 years, anything like the temperature we have now, by direct measurement. And this is the last 150 years of data from the three groups that really try to make a global surface temperature measurement. The Hadley Met Office in the Climate Research Unit in England, NOAA here in the U.S., and NASA here in the U.S., and they all agree very, very well. They make slightly different assumptions about how you sample or correct for the Arctic, where you don't have many stations. But you can sort of see there was warming until the 30s, the cooling after World War II for a couple decades, and since about 1970 or 75, this warming has no explanation except greenhouse gases. Nothing else. Not solar, not variability, not El Niños, nothing else.
It's the world output of CO2 gases that seems to be being indicated here is much higher than, say, in the early industrial age.
Absolutely. Yeah, we know that. The reported data is probably good to 10%, maybe a few percent as a trend. The actual measurement of CO2 in the atmosphere is good to a tenth of a percent, so we know it very, very well. It's not solar. So here's solar. We put up satellites to measure the total output of the sun. It has an 11-year cycle, solar max, solar min, solar max, solar min, solar max, solar min. If anything is maybe a little bit down over the last three decades. And it's varying by a very small amount. This is a tenth of a percent.
But the solar variable is a tenth of a percent, and nothing in there explains, says that the sun is responsible for the warming. That is just rejected by the data that we know. Okay, back to your question about what causes the warming. If there was no push or pull on the Earth's temperature system, we'd be at zero. The greenhouse gases capture the outgoing heat, the infrared of the Earth, not the visible light, the infrared, by their vibrations, CO2, methane, they can couple with the temperature, with the wavelength of the Earth's radiation. Everything radiates, your body radiates heat. So if I had an infrared camera, I can get all of you. You would radiate heat. The Earth's radiating heat at about room temperature. And it couples very well with the vibrations of CO2, methane, and other gases like nitrous oxide and freons. Aerosol pulsing, these little smoke particles and dust particles over here, they have a cooling effect. They bounce sunlight back to space, let less sunlight in, so it doesn't get as warm. So there's sort of a competition between these two, and we think that the greenhouse gases are winning. So the greenhouse gas forcing, 3 minus 1 or 1.5, leaves us over here. The net forcing is about 1 or 2 watts per meter squared. 4 watts per meter squared is double CO2. So we're about almost halfway to double CO2 already. If we stopped today, we would still have another couple degrees of warming.
Does that mean we bring back the hairspray cans and
you say aerosol, but that aerosol wouldn't get up high enough. And the freons that were in those cans would make this part much worse. Each freon molecule is 10,000 times more potent than CO2. So you don't want to bring the freons back, no. But you might want to fly a jet airplane in the stratosphere and shoot out sulfuric acid and make clouds. People are going to do this. It's the cheapest geoengineering solution. Some individual person can do this, less than $1 billion a year. Some guy who wants to stop global warming on his own could fly up in the stratosphere, put a couple million tons of sulfuric acid up there, and buck out most of global warming. So this is a geoengineering solution which is being debated by religious moral theologians as well as by climate scientists.
Where's Richard Branson?
I don't know.
Isn't he kind of spaceship now?
This is just to show you real data. The amount of heat, what is the temperature, the heat content of the ocean over the last 7 or 8 years, and it's going up. Why? Because we live on a blue planet. Blue water absorbs sunlight. Most of the heat, extra heat, that's going into the Earth system is being absorbed by the ocean, not warming the land. If there were no oceans, we'd be warming up a lot faster. So ocean heating is delaying, moderating the rate of warming.
Does the Earth's magnetism play into
not
that?
Not much. Not much, no. Only for charged particles reaching the poles, and maybe in the stratosphere or mesosphere, but not for global warming. Okay, we're almost done. Climate change is real, it's happening now. We are causing most of the change. Climate scientists agree on this. The impact will be bad for people and the natural world. What are some of those impacts? Again, this is global, but you could bring this down to the Pacific Northwest in many ways. Food, up to a degree or so, for some high latitude countries, Canada, perhaps, Russia, high northern U.S. Regions, increasing crop yields because longer growing seasons, a little bit warmer. But as you go from yellow into red, red means bad, yellow means okay, or watch out. For almost everywhere else, where all the poor people of color live in Africa and in Asia, all the temperature increases are bad. Anything beyond 3 or 4 degrees, really bad. You lose the rice, you lose the corn, you lose the wheat. Falling yields in almost all developed regions and all developing regions. So we really don't want to go up here. What's safe? The United Nations and countries of the world at this climate conference have said 2 degrees, that's it. That's the bumper, that's the guardrail. Don't let the warming get bigger than that. Do we have a shot at that? I'm not optimistic. I don't think we have a chance. But if we really got serious now, we might be able to stop the warming at 2. I think we're heading for this.
Why would it only be possible raising yields in northern latitudes?
Oh.
For the simple mind, it says what's growing in the U.S. now will grow great in Canada later.
If they have the same soils. Some of our soils, the loess soils, the corn belt, those soils don't exist under heat pause up here. They don't have these soils. Water. Small mountain glaciers disappear. Water supplies threatened in several areas. This is already happening now. There are a lot of cities, Lima, Peru, and other cities in India, where all the summer water is coming from glacier melt. And there's no glaciers, there'll be no water in the summer for them. Significant decreases in water available in many areas, including Mediterranean and South Africa. Saudi Arabia tried for about 10 years to grow their own wheat. They pumped all their groundwater, that's all gone. Now they can't grow any wheat. import all their wheat. And a lot of Middle Eastern countries import all their grain. And if we go to 4 or 5 degrees, we're going to have major sea level rise. My talk is really not about sea level, but I think we're going to get 1 or 2 meters of sea level rise. Even with 1 meter, half the rice growing areas of Vietnam are gone, half the rice growing areas of Bangladesh are gone. Ecosystem. We're going to lose the coral reefs, probably. Like we're going to lose the western forests in the U.S., we're going to lose most coral reefs, probably. Even at 1 or 2 degrees, it's already happening now. Rising numbers of species facing extinction. Extreme, increasing storms, forest fires, droughts, floods, etc. All these things get worse. They all get worse. The higher we go, the worse they are. And then there's things that we're not talking about. Are we going to lose the Amazon forest? Is the Gulf Stream going to stop? Is Greenland ice field going to melt? Are we going to lose the Antarctic ice pack? All these things, we don't know where these tipping points are, but they're out there. And the higher we go, the more likely they are. It's like, well, I drank a six-pack, and it was icy roads, and I drove home, and I crashed my car. Did the icy roads make me crash the car? Did the six-pack make me crash the car? It added some likelihood. It increased the likelihood that I was going to have a wreck. So climate change and all this increased greenhouse gas forcing increases the likelihood of these things happening. We can't ever say that a particular storm, drought, flood, et cetera, is due to global warming. You could just say, we're loading the dice. We're loading the dice.
Yeah. On that slide under temperature bar,
let me go back.
Indicated that there was a hard line that was proposed at 2 degrees
yes.
Celsius, and
yeah.
The temperature bar continues up beyond 5. In your opinion and expertise, is it feasible to move that temperature on increased CO2 only?
I don't quite understand your question.
Is CO2 the driving component in the greenhouse gas
yes.
effect that would raise that?
Yes.
And not water vapor?
No. Water vapor is a feedback that is determined by the temperature of the ocean only. So water vapor increases 7% for each degree centigrade. And the water vapor, because we've already had about half a degree centigrade warming of the surface ocean, the humidity of the global atmosphere has gone up about 4 or 5% measured. And so water vapor is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, but it's locked to CO2. So CO2 causes the warming, which causes the water vapor to increase, which increases the warming.
So you're basically saying they're feeding on each other.
They are. It's a feedback.
I thought methane was worse for the...
Per molecule is worse. It's 20 times worse, but the methane concentration is really small.
And it's not something that's growing?
It's more than triple. It's gone up a lot, but it's still small. There's a big concern about methane from Arctic permafrost, etc. And clathrates. And so I used to measure methane in 1982, and it was going up and then sort of leveled off in the 90s, and now it's going up again. And whether this is tropical deforestation or whether this is the permafrost starting to let go, we don't know. But methane is a special word, one of these climate guns that we don't really know about. But most of the warming has been due to CO2, is due to CO2, and continue to be due to CO2. The feedback to water vapor doubles the warming from CO2 by itself.
Permafrost, methane is outgassing, or
it's all this sort of rotting carbon that's laid down there every winter, just sitting there under the bog, frozen. All right, so you just melt that, and there's no oxygen there, and the bugs that make the methane, they need warm anaerobic conditions and a source of carbon, and they make it. Whether it's in the guts of termites or cattle or your gut or in a swamp, same thing, the pathogens. Okay, there's the guardrail, and the world community has said up here is dangerous. The Framework Convention on Climate Change said we must stop the increase of gases in the atmosphere at such a level as to prevent, quote, dangerous man-made interference with the climate system. And the world community, climate policy people in meetings have said 2 degrees is it. That's where we got to go. I don't think we have a 50-50 chance to go there. What's going to happen? Well, John Holdren put it very well. We're going to have to mitigate. We have to avoid the change to which we cannot adapt. We have to adapt. We have to adapt to the change which we can no longer avoid. And we have to minimize harm, human suffering, damage to the natural world. Who suffers and who benefits? We'll probably be okay, right? We can move, we can get in our cars, we can turn on the air conditioning. There are a lot of people who are going to suffer. A lot of people are going to die. What do we have to do? Well, here's the track we're on, and if we can increase emissions, that's where we're headed. If we stabilize emissions, does that mean the atmosphere stops going up? No, it's like a bucket with no leak in the bucket and no evaporation. You've got a hose in the bucket. The level in the bucket's going up. You don't have to make the water come in faster and faster. You can have a constant drip into the bucket. And it keeps going up. It's going to keep going up. This is accelerating water into the bucket. This is a level, a steady flow of water into the bucket. It still goes up. The only way to have the bucket stop increasing the water level is to turn off the faucet. Reduce the emissions. A lot. 80% or more. Basically, the world has got to get off of fossil fuels. And we've got to do it fast. We have to do it in your lifetime, certainly the lifetime of your children. That's where we have to go. Can we do it? The goal is that more than 80% by 2050, certainly the lifetime of our children, that's where we have to go. 80% down for the world probably means all the way off for us. What our president committed to on his own, without any support from Congress, said that by 2020, he wanted the U.S. to drop 17% below 2005. That would be getting here by 2020. Now, Europe is already below us, and they're going down. We're actually doing this year, because of the recession, because of fracking and natural gas, and people driving more efficient cars and driving less, we're actually decreasing about 2% a year. So we're on track, actually, to make this. Even without cap and trade, even without a carbon tax, even without an international treaty, the U.S. is actually on track to meet this goal.
So we just have to continue on a bad economy.
I hope that that's not the reason. I hope we can go quicker into non-fossil fuel energy sources.
I see that you have India in there, and they're right now trending to be the fastest growing economy in the world. I see that taking the same path as China within the next couple of years.
Yeah, China passed us in CO2 emissions a few years ago, in 2007, and India also going to come up behind it. And they're going to say, don't tell us not to develop. You guys burn the carbon. We're not trying to be poor. And they have a strong moral argument to make there. I think that Brazil and some other countries have actually pledged to make, as developing countries, to actually stop and start reducing their emissions. But that's a very hard sell with developing countries.
So by that, U.S. is currently number two for production?
Yes. Yeah. After China. I'm almost done. So MIT did a study that said, if we ignore this and just burn CO2, burn fossil carbon, business as usual, here's the great roulette wheel. Here's the kind of climate change we might make if we have no climate policy. We might get away with only 3 or 4 degrees C, but there's a good chance we're going to get 5 degrees C by 2100. Again, in the lifetime of children born today or their children. If we have a strong climate policy, we might be able to stop the warming at 1 or 2 degrees. I don't think so. I think we're going to be at 2 or 2.5 degrees, even with strong climate policy. So these are kind of the choices that we have. I think I'm done. Okay. But I think that there is hope if we start now to avoid the worst. Not to avoid any climate change, because it's already happening. I like this cartoon. Global warming isn't happening. It is happening. And if it's happening, maybe it's a good thing. It's not a good thing. And if it's not a good thing, then it can't be confirmed. It has been confirmed. And if it's been confirmed, maybe it's not caused by humans. It is caused by humans. And even if it's caused by humans, maybe it'll fix itself. It won't fix itself. And if it won't fix itself, there's nothing we can do. There are things we can do. And if there are things we can do, they're too expensive. They're not too expensive. And if they're not too expensive, we can postpone doing them. We can't postpone doing them. What do you mean? We've had this conversation already for over a decade, and they're just warming up. This was 2005. We wrote that cartoon. And that's where we are. That's where we are. In fact, I'm really concerned. I'm a Democrat. But I'm really concerned that we need a discussion about the science, an apolitical discussion. And somehow this topic has become so politicized. There are two major parties that, and I hope that when Obama and Romney have a debate, that it comes up as one of the questions that they can talk about. Let's talk about climate science and what the U.S. should be doing. I certainly don't see it so far. I like this one to finish. Climate summit. Energy independence, preserve forests, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, renewable clean water, healthy children, all that. And this guy in the audience said, hey, what if it's a big hoax and we create a better world for nothing? Abraham Lincoln said, let the people know the facts and the country will be safe. That's what I'm trying to do, is let people know the facts. So these are some of the things we might want to talk about as questions. These are some of the main questions that skeptics raise about the climate science. But let me stop there and see if there are questions. I'm sorry I went long.
Yeah, Larry Costello, Morgan Kennedy. First of all, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For coming out. It's always a pleasure to hear this kind of information from an expert. Just to go on the record myself, I am a skeptic. I'm a professional engineer, electrical, 30 years experience. I know independent consulting practice. I know science, too. I can't produced the facts and data that, that you have endeavored in that area. But as a reasonably intelligent person,
right,
I can read what's out there, and I've talked to a lot of other esteemed individuals such as yourself with credentials that are, I would say, are comparable to yours. And there's a very large body of experts that disagree with what you present. You argued in your early slide that it's, there's no question that this is what it is. For your opinion, not a public opinion, there are some very esteemed individuals in our local community, Dr. Gordon Foltz, Dr. Don Easterbrook, Mark Albright, Todd Meyer, Bobby Corser, Ken Schlicky, Chuck Wise. These are individuals with meteorology, climatology expertise, astrophysicists, and they would disagree based on the conversations with them. So there's a very large body of individuals that don't line up with what you said in its entirety or in part. There's 32,000 individuals of science. These are individuals with PhDs, over 9,000 of them, engineers, climatologists, meteorologists, environmentalists, biologists, medical experts that have signed a petition denouncing the global effect of anthropogenic and CO2 emission caused global warming. This is on record. It can be easily traced. It's called the climate change petition. And so there's quite a mass of individuals. I would like to allow us to go back to your early slide, too, where you talked about the survey proclaiming 97%. That was particularly interesting to me. Dr. Don Easterbrook just so happened to give me a slide that, and if you're referring to the American Geological Union survey, which did use that very same thing.
American Geophysical Union.
Oh, okay. My apologies. My understanding from how that survey was conducted, they issued 10,257 surveys to individuals that they felt were credible persons to respond to the survey concerning their impressions of global warming and such. So these were supposedly individuals that were qualified to offer an opinion. Okay. They got back 3,146. And of that, there was a cherry-picked selection of 77 of those surveys that were just exclusively climatologists. So they initially solicited 10,000, only received 3,146. 77 were cherry-picked for actually recording the survey. And of those 77, 75 agreed with essentially what Dr. Gannon.
Could you define what you mean by cherry pick? You're saying they ignored 2,900 some of the responses and chose just use 70 some.
And the result was this 97% reporting that comes out. And this, again, was a fact. I didn't make this up. This was given for life to me by Dr. Don Easterbrook. He's a professor emeritus of geology from Western Washington University, so he comes with a student who gives us as well. And just so happened that this was ironic or coincidence that you talked about this evening. So I'm not here to impugn what you've said. I don't want to come across that way. The point I'm really trying to make, and I direct my comments more at our elected officials and the board here in our community, because that's what this dialogue is really all about, that there is a very, very large body of credible scientists that hold a very different opinion. The IPCC was admonished in 2010 by the IAC. It was an organization that policed in the wake of the ClimateGate debacle, where the Mann hockey curve, as I understand it, by many of these experts has been successfully debunked as false science. Again, I can't debate your touch again, but if these other individuals that I referred to here locally, and they have expressed an interest and willingness to come before this commission and the city council, if we wanted to have a fair and open discussion where we bring experts from the other point of view to the table, we would be able to hear from other perspectives at the comparable level that Dr. Gannon is. I can't deliver that message. I'm kind of a messenger, but I can't originate that. I would attempt to. Another interesting example, I had the benefit of previewing a slide deck from a presentation that you made at Antioch University in 2007. Several of the slides in your presentation tonight are from that, apparently. One of the slides, you showcased a scientist, an expert in the field, a gentleman by the name of James Lovelock, and his he had written a book called the Gaia, as I understand it, and in that book, based on his expertise, he was proclaiming that the world was heading for literally near-term disaster, where literally billions of people were going to die as a result of the global warming.
He did say that.
I know, and you quoted it on your slide. In his recent book, The Revenge of Gaia, Professor Lovelock predicts that global warming will kill billions of people this century. He said the Earth is undergoing a rapid transition that could boost temperatures by 8 degrees C, making large parts of the surface uninhabitable and food production impossible. A hotter planet might be able to support less than a tenth of its current population. We are not all doomed, he said. An awful lot of people will die, but I don't see the species dying out. So that was language on your slide. Now, ironically enough, on April 23rd of 2012, just 3 months ago, Dr. Lovelock, in an interview with MSNBC, and he was also interviewed by the UK Guardian, had basically recanted everything he's pronounced in his book, The Gaia. A quote in the interview, "The problem is we don't know what the climate is doing. We thought we knew 20 years ago. That led to some alarmist books, mine included, because it looked clear cut, but it hasn't happened." Another quote in that interview, he says, this pertains more to sustainable and renewable energy. "We rushed into renewable energy without any thought. The schemes are largely hopelessly inefficient and unpleasant. So-called sustainable development, like wind power, is meaningless drivel." So here's an individual that, you know, was apparently regarded in very high esteem. And I'm just wondering, perhaps, if you could comment on that correlation. It's kind of an interesting irony.
He's an extreme outlier. He is not a climate scientist, but his training was in medicine, actually. He's a systems thinker. He thinks about the Earth as a living system. That's what Gaia is, a self-regulating living system. And Gaia is not for us. He would say, we're the irritant. And Gaia is going to turn us as a grain of sand into a pearl. It's going to spit us out or something. So he is way out there, and both in his prediction of what might happen, in his views about alternative energy and solar power. What he did brilliantly, that really was a great contribution, not as a climate scientist, he sort of had this systems view of the Earth and biogeochemical feedbacks. And he sort of said, you know, what are the ways that the Earth might regulate itself? Daisy rolls is the image that he used. And so scientists have gone out to try to dispute, reject the Gaia hypothesis. He would call it Gaia science now. But nobody really found such a strong biological control, feedback, stabilizing control of the Earth system by the biota. That's really what's his grand vision. But it set in motion all of these climate scientists looking for feedbacks. How does methane affect things? How does dimethyl sulfide emitted from phytoplankton create marine stratus clouds and cool the climate? Another sort of daisy roll idea. So all of these ideas about feedbacks involving the biota came out of Lovelock's ideas about Gaia. He's kind of a crazy guy. He actually came to Seattle once or twice. But yeah, I wouldn't put you, and I put him in my talk sort of as one extreme, not that he doesn't represent the IPCC by any means.
You have also commented that CO2 is the single biggest contributor, and again, we talked about that very briefly.
About 60%, 70%.
Okay. I was given some authorization to be able to at least speak a little bit on their behalf, but Dr. Don Easterbrook would contend with that and stipulates that 95% of global warming is attributed to the water vapor. So again, bear with me on that. I would like to ask our community representatives to consider having other experts like that to hear another perspective.
Mr. Invited to come tonight?
They weren't invited.
This is a public meeting.
Absolutely open.
Didn't have enough time to coordinate.
But it seems like as the city, you would provide that without us asking and provide it Dallas perspective.
The notice that this kind of a presentation was available and was going to be conducted, I received one.
Well, let's not get hung up on why one person was invited or not.
Exactly.
Let me finish, because the reality is we are reaching out to people, and if we get a commitment and we can book that person and give you guys a perspective, and there's somebody else that you guys want to suggest, hey, more information the better. That's how good decisions are made. So there's no intent here to have one perspective or the other. So let's, kind of.
And I wasn't suggesting.
Yeah. No, I know. I just wanted to
just
clarify so nobody felt
suggesting that there's an opportunity to hear another perspective, because the argument that Dr. Gammon has made is that this is effectively settled science.
It
from
is.
What I've read, it's far from settled science, and there are thousands of experts of esteemed qualifications that disagree with
100%.
That.
100%.
Well, again, I'm not prepared to...
I would refer the committee to the website called Climate Communications, and this one of the questions is on the slide right now. Do climate scientists agree that the world is warming and that humans are the cause? Here's the answers. Scientists with relevant experience agree that the world is unequivocally warming. And I would reject retired petroleum engineers without having relevant experience. Relevant experience means, are you a climate scientist? Do you publish in Journal of Climate, Journal of Geophysical Research, Nature, Science? These are the people. Don't have a PhD, that's fine. You have a PhD in neuroscience. You know, when you have a brain tumor, you don't go to a chiropractor. The people who really have relevant experience, that what matter. Climate scientists who publish climate science research. Those are the people you ask.
I would also like to refer the commission here to the United States Senate Subcommittee on Environment and Public Works. There's a very large body of information that's been amassed there with over 700 experts that have testified before that committee, and their words and their body of work is well represented there. I had accumulated a lot of quotes out of that just as a kind of a cross-section. I know we don't have enough time to wade into all of those, but there are many examples where...
To that, we'd love for you to submit, though, any of that that you'd like to submit. Oh,
thank
to
you. And really, yeah. I, again, there's just simply not enough time for that to go through all of it. So.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something?
No. He referred to a lot of large body of work out there. So recruiting what the professor said here. And, you know, I've read a lot on this. I'm looking for data and read books, and we all can't support what he's presented.
Let me add one more thing.
What theory does Dr. Houston make yet? Does he have the data back?
Oh, absolutely. He's using the same data, the IPCC data. The IPCC also was, like I said, significantly and severely admonished because of their what had been reported to be manipulated, underreported, internalized, protecting the data to deliver what was presented in the admonishment as a politicized report. And that was the 2007 IPCC report, the fourth report that IPCC has issued. It is in the IAC, and you know, I've
lost myself on the acronyms.
Inter-Academy Council is what produced that report, and you probably were familiar with that.
Do the errors in the IPCC report undermine confidence in the science? No. Two small errors have been found in one of the IPCC 2007 reports. Neither has anything to do with the basic conclusions that the globe is unequivocally warming and that human activity is the primary cause. These mistakes were acknowledged and corrected, and review procedures are strengthened to avoid future errors. And a report of over 3,000 pages by hundreds of authors is not unusual. There'd be a few minor errors. Contrarians seeking to discredit climate science and some in the media have blown these errors out of proportion. If you go on this website, these are the questions which I had put on the slide.
One thing to keep in mind as we go forward, too, is this is obviously a big topic, and a big topic worldwide. And instead of getting hung up on whether we're going to convince one person of one perspective or another, in the end, what we're trying to bring to you is information that can be collected to help you make decisions as we put our plans together in North Bend. So what would be nice is if we could debate all night about whether it's man-made or...
I don't want to do that, because that's a false debate.
And so
it's a waste of time.
And so what I'm wondering is there questions that you have?
Actually, Mr. Chair, so I can, you know that I can't influence coal-fired plants in China, but what I don't understand is how much in a mile of blacktop and how much in 100 homes with asphalt roofs does that contribute or not contribute, and what are the alternatives that would then be beneficial that we might be able to do in our city?
Alternatives to using asphalt. Well, two things about asphalt. It's black, and it's kind of a waste product of fossil fuel industry, right? There are no direct emissions from the blacktop on the hot day. It's not directly contributed to greenhouse gas. It does trap heat and makes things hotter. So blacktops and black roofs and all of that is worse than a lighter colored surface or a green roof, for sure. And if you're an urban planner, that's important.
In a little broader perspective, Gary, what you were saying, I was curious, but, you know, you've given us, as you said you would, that very global, large perspective. We're down at the 1,000-foot level. Can you bring us down out of 30,000-foot and maybe just even talk a little bit about what's going on in Washington or what we should be expecting or what we think we could do?
Yeah, not my area, and I saw the earlier correspondence when you were trying to get a speaker. I think that somebody from the Climate Impacts Group at the University of Washington, they're specifically looking at the impacts on Washington State with high-resolution models on the hydrology, snowpack, forestry, fisheries, and public health. They would give you the regional local impacts better than I. In terms of solutions, I really am a fan of Climate Solutions, Casey Golden and those people. They really are working with farmers in eastern Washington and Idaho, looking at win-win solutions to climate change issues. So I'm not an expert in either of those. I would take these broad views and say, what might happen here in the Northwest? You're going to have more violent weather. You're going to have more severe floods when they come. You may have droughts. You're going to have less snowpack. You're going to have pest invasions in the forest, more forest fire danger, less stability in crops, those sort of things. Maybe West Nile. What else do we have here? Hantavirus. I don't know if you have hantavirus. You have to have rooms for that. More
southeastern.
How do you respond to the data that's come out of the NOAA National Climatic Data Center that indicates the annual temperatures at SeaTac Airport have trended down at a rate of 0.7 degrees Fahrenheit per decade during the last 20 years?
I haven't seen the data, but I trust that source, and it's one spot. And one way, and there's fog over there today. I took my dog to the beach in Puget Sound, and whenever it's really hot over here, we get rain fog come in. Same in West Fork, like a salmon fishing. So that doesn't prove anything. Local changes are not climate. Local changes are weather.
Again, from some of the other experts that I've seen go on the record, there's data that demonstrates that the global average temperatures since 1998 have actually been holding constant or downward trending.
I showed you data that refutes that.
And there's other data that does.
I don't think so. These three, the Climate Research Unit from East Anglia, NOAA, and NASA all have the same thing. I said they disagree slightly about the Arctic. And that way, maybe 2005 is warmer than 2010, but they're all up there. 2010, 2005 are warmer than 1998. And the trend, the decade of the 2000 to 2010 is warmer than the 90s. So the decadal average, which is climate, continues to warm.
Earth has cooled since 1998 in defiance of prediction by the UN IPCC. The world temperature for 2007 is the coldest in the decade and the coldest of the millennium, which is why global warming is not called climate change. Now, the report from climatologist Dr. Richard Keene of the Department of Atmospheric and Ocean Sciences at the University of Colorado.
That's not the consensus of the international science community.
So again, I think debating, refuting is not really going to. We'd love for you to submit the data. We should take all of that into consideration. Doctor also offered up.
I thought this was a Q&A opportunity. My question.
Well, it is. I didn't hear a question.
Pardon me?
I didn't hear a question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the question started off with there was discussion about the we should be prepared for these warming effects here in our local community. You wanted to drive things down to 1,000-foot level. We were talking about possible concerns about West Nile virus and other diseases or whatever biological threats we might be exposed to. But yet the data was showing that we're actually in a downward trend here. NOAA data here in the Pacific Northwest. So should we be jumping out with alarmism about this, or should we be stepping back and looking at a more broader base of information to draw more rational conclusions here for our local community? That was the point of my question, and then we segued off to some of these other back and forth. But yeah, I will give my information to you. I'm happy to do that too.
Just as a point of information, Mr. Chair, that NOAA did the 2012 climate data for global warming, and 2010. Nine of the 10 warmest years since 1880 have occurred since the year 2000. Nine of the 10 warmest years have occurred since the year 2000. So I'll provide all this to the Climate Commission.
Well, let's look at a little anecdotal information here. Let's look down to the
everybody. We've had folks come in. And one that stands out in mind is when we were talking about routing trucks and cars and so forth, especially in our school areas. And the anecdote is simple. There here are these buses idling, these toxic fumes, right next to our kids who are waiting to unload the bus. And I don't need hard science to convince me that, you know, something's not right there. So I think there are things that we have in our own experiences that can lend us to make a rational decision, as you pointed out, while we're considering all the different information that we have. And I certainly would like to read that. I'm a fan of debate, but at the same time, we have some ground level grassroots thing that I think you're trying to tap at. I think that's the passion here. And I think we're all pulling from that right now. So I don't want to waste any more professors' time. So if we have questions that can really help us get down to that 10-foot level, the 1,000-foot level, that we can really use your expertise. And by you guys being here and listening to that, that's great, because if you want to offer an alternate opinion, then you know what it is that we're listening to and what we're considering. So if we could kind of go in that direction, that might be a constructive use of time.
Well, that's a good segue, Mike. I believe you wanted to share some of that more.
Yeah, bringing down to the 10-foot level, what is it that, how does that impact North Bend? And what are options that we can consider should we choose that path? So I just wanted to give a quick background again as to why we're doing the sustainability element of the comprehensive plan. So state requirements, again, the state has set greenhouse gas reduction goals for state agencies, not for local jurisdictions, but that does set an example. The sustainability requirements for public buildings receiving state agencies and for grant eligibility. I mean, we mentioned this in previous workshops, that if we want to receive grants from agencies of the state providing competitive grant funds, which are some very significant sources, we do need to show that we have policies addressing greenhouse gas emission reduction. The ethics, and this gets back to the debate, but the broader perspective of it is the right thing to do, that preserving the future environment of our children, and preparedness. So change is happening, change is inevitable, and if we plan ahead, we come out ahead. Again, just to summarize, we need to keep any policy in North Bend simple, easy to implement, with a limited staff and a limited budget. So preparedness, there's two aspects of what I wanted to talk about. Climate change is happening. How are we responding as a community to that? And then the second part, greenhouse gas emissions, which gets back to the larger discussion. Should we be addressing that, and how should we be addressing that as a community? So the principal impacts for North Bend specifically, we're not going to be dealing with sea level rise here in North Bend. Obviously, there's huge sectors of the economy that could be impacted by climate change nationally and globally, but what's happening here in North Bend that could result? So I think the biggest one is flooding. The increased storm events, increased temperatures during the winter, leading to decreased snowpack and increased flooding, decreased water availability during the summer from that snowpack, which then impacts energy costs and droughts.
Mike, since we look at some of the data and we see warming in other places and we're cool here, would we see any chance of migration shifts where people just don't like that warmer climate and prefer cooler climates anywhere in the Northwest region, whether it be North Bend, Issaquah, Snoqualmie, you know, are we thinking about any types of that type of migration of just people coming into the town?
Possibly on a national scale.
I didn't say that, but I was going to say that, you know, if you put a bubble around the Northwest and nothing bad happened here, and it was horrible in the Southwest and other parts of the U.S., they're going to come here. And some people here are going to go up to Canada.
We're changing the info on our website.
Yeah.
Don't come. Have a nice visit.
10th Iowa, 106 degrees.
Yeah. Hard to be.
We're going to change from easy to get too hard to leave. It's hard to get to and easy to leave.
This is too cold.
So in terms of flooding, what are we doing to address flooding? And flooding is something that the climate change models predict will increase the severity of. So we've just spent quite a bit of time in our floodplain development plan which calls for exploring opportunities to reduce the flood hazards in the community. So levee setbacks, working with the county on their gravel removal projects, studies that are examining what are our alternatives to decrease the severity of flooding that happens. The FEMA elevation and buyout programs, repetitive loss properties. Stormwater is another aspect of it, so that's not from flooding necessarily, but from precipitation, heavy rainfall events. And the next thing that we're going to be taking on as a city, just talk to Ron about this, is we need to update our stormwater management plan. So there'll be some recommendations as to what we need to change in our capital facilities to improve our system capacity. And just making sure that we stay current with updates as necessary. We have adopted the current edition of the King County Surface Water Design Manual by reference in our code. So as that's updated by the county, it's also updated here. Energy costs, obviously, are tied mainly with snowpack in the Northwest, as we're very much dependent on hydroelectricity here. So as a hedge against future increases, energy conservation can make a big difference for local taxpayers. That can happen through doing energy audits of our buildings and our systems. Wastewater treatment plants are a huge energy source, or not source, user. And as we look to build new buildings, potentially a new city hall, other new buildings and infrastructure, can use green building techniques that can reduce energy consumption. Reduced water availability has a big impact in North Bend. We draw from the Snoqualmie River, or we draw from a spring, the Hobo Spring, up by Rattlesnake Lake. And when that reaches a certain level down from its normal flow, we are required to mitigate for that water by providing additional water, or I'm sorry, other way around. We have a from our aquifer, which is fed by the Snoqualmie River. When the Snoqualmie River reaches a certain level of flow, we're required by our agreement to supplement that from our Hobo Springs Reservoir. And we pay about $85,000 a year now to mitigate from those low flows. So in drought years, that can be a significant cost impact in the city.
Is that changing over the last decade, do you believe?
That's a relatively new agreement. We were in a water moratorium for over 10 years. And just came out of that about 2 years ago.
We have had a lot of problems for 10 years.
So how can we address that? How can we reduce the costs to our taxpayers? Obviously, reducing water consumption plays greatly into that. So first of all, where are our system leakages? That's actually a big water loss in Northland. And then reducing per capita usage and encouraging native and drought tolerant landscaping. Then climate change and greenhouse gas emissions. This is where it gets into more of the political aspect of things. So first of all, what is the state requiring? The state has set greenhouse gas reduction goals for state agencies. They have not applied this to cities, but to 1990 levels by 2020, and then as you extend beyond that to 2030, I think it's 10% below 1990 levels, and then by 2050, 20% below 1990 levels. Likewise, reducing a goal of reducing vehicle miles traveled by 18% by 2020, as transportation is the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions. Requires the Department of Ecology to inventory and track greenhouse gas emissions statewide, and requires industries then to report their greenhouse gas emissions to the Department of Ecology so that we understand the long-term picture of what's happening. Likewise, state agencies are required to report their emissions and to create plans that identify how they will achieve those reduction goals. We already mentioned the grant eligibility requirement. We need to develop policies showing that we are reducing our greenhouse gas emissions locally in North Bend.
And not the biggest factor up there impacting us.
That's the biggest factor to North Bend there, yeah. And these are just direct greenhouse gas emissions policies. we've had a number of workshops prior to this that have addressed energy conservation, fossil fuel use, et cetera, that are also addressing greenhouse gas emissions. And the state has a number of additional measures and policies to set reductions there.
So eligibility for grants, can you go back to that? So
yeah.
It says for infrastructure and economic development projects, so is that all the so grants that are associated to anything that we want to do around infrastructure or economic development, we potentially would miss grants if we don't?
Potentially, yes. These are the big sources. The Public Works Trust Fund loan, it's the... What?
The economic development.
That's the majority of the funding.
Grants coming out of Department of Commerce, Department of Transportation.
So it impacts a pretty large amount of money that potentially can come into the city.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the only reason we should make a change.
What's that?
That's not the reason to make a change.
No, I know, because I'm just like, wow, I might as well just mark those off the list, because I think those are really hard numbers to achieve, especially when we're talking about...
No, they're not saying you have to get to the numbers to get the grants. What they're saying is, show us how you're thinking about this, so if we're going to hand you money, we're handing it to a city, an organization.
So have a plan. It may not be a 100% achievable plan. It may be a 25% achievable plan, but we'll give you money.
Well, the way that I read it is, as most competitive grants are, there's a rating system, a ranking system, and
yes.
If you,
just like
you're missing elements,
yeah.
You're going to miss points,
yep.
Right? So the potential to lose
yeah.
goes up.
Yep.
So this gets into more, I want to open up a discussion, but in terms of reducing emissions, what are most cities that address this doing? And the typical process is that you start with an inventory. You go out and collect data about what is happening with our city's operations, our systems and our buildings, what are the emissions created by the use of fossil fuels, by the use of electrical energy, etc. What are the sources coming from our community's transportation and our community's energy use as a whole? And then setting reduction targets. So saying within 15 years we want to reduce our target to the 1990 level of emissions. And then following from that, an action plan of how you're going to get there. And that quote there is just from the US EPA website on greenhouse gas emissions, talking about why it is good to set those set that in play.
I'm curious, Mike. Two perspectives. One, how many cities are on board and are creating plans, if you have an idea as far as count? And then the flip side of that, how many cities are saying, no, this is ridiculous, we're not. I'm sure
I believe it's about half the cities in King County have some sort of climate change policy either in place or in process. And that's just from sitting on a couple of workshops where they identified, you know, who's working on a sustainability plan, who's working on, who signed the U.S. Conference of Mayors Climate Protection Agreement, who's done this and that measures, and I think it's when you totaled it, it's about half the cities.
So if the other half, are there any cities that are taking firm opposition against going in this direction?
I don't know. So the question that I have, though, that I want to open it up for discussion is, we're a small city, and if we were to spend our time creating the inventory, tracking that data over time, that's a lot of work and a lot of expense and a lot of staff time. And that may not be the most efficient way to actually address the problem. The chart there that you see is the Washington State greenhouse gas inventory as prepared by the Department of Ecology. And that was from 2008. That's a little bit old, but that's the most recent data that I had available. And you can see the largest source is transportation, followed by electrical energy use, followed by RCI, which was
all that.
Residential, commercial, industrial, and it's basically heating. It's use of fossil fuels. So So those three categories, you can understand what you have to do. If you're going to address transportation, you're coming back to land use patterns, alternatives to single occupancy vehicle use, encouraging pedestrian and bicycle use. If you're looking at electrical energy use, it's about obviously increasing energy efficiency in your buildings and your systems. And the same thing with heat.
Well, your real question is what does that get us? Right? What's the incentive to go and measure it
right
where we are, and then measure at some point down the road to say where we got to by a change in policy, right?
Right.
And
right.
So it would seem like the opening gamut would be is if it is only logical that if we make some changes that we would see improvements in these, okay, great, we don't really need to measure it in order to know that there logically would be an improvement. The reason to measure it would be is there some incentive, is there
right
something out there like these grants going to be tied to
right
the measurement that would be a reason to expend that kind of energy
yeah
and effort.
And that's not currently a state mandate. We're not required, like state agencies in certain industries are, to track the greenhouse gas.
Are there other things, or are there other reasons that I'm not thinking of that would push us to want to?
I would think for a number of larger cities, Bellevue, Seattle, et cetera, that have certain sectors of industries, or you know, something that they can then target down and say, well, this is particular to our city. But given that we're a very small community, we don't have particular industries here, and the only thing that we have is the truck town, and we again know that that's an emissions-related source. And it's pretty clear things that you need to do if you're dealing with vehicle emissions.
Well, there's another thing here, though, is that it's contributing to the body of data and science that we have. And I look at it more as a social responsibility. If we have the ability to somehow collect data that can contribute to the body of knowledge to settle debates and so forth, then at some level, if it's feasible for our community to do so, then maybe it's an obligation, a social obligation. The next question I would have is that I know hiring teams of professionals to come in and do longitudinal studies could be costly. I wonder if there are any things that are less costly that we could explore. You know, I'm thinking of like the mad high school scientist who's putting salt and sugar and water together to come up with something. You know, are there economical things that we could explore where it wouldn't take that level of expertise, but it would be available to whomever's in the community that does have that level of expertise to really have access to it. Maybe you could speak to
that. Well, I would say the instruments like that. Because you're small, maybe you don't need to do it. On the other hand, because you're small, maybe it's not so hard to do it. Maybe there's some drop-in Excel spreadsheet, get some private help, student interns or something. And also, you know, you can say, we're super green. This is an economic, it's a marketing thing for your city as a green place for tourism. Mm-hmm.
I guess part of the question is, what is it that we would be measuring and how would we be measuring it? Are these types of things that we can inventory and measure at a local level with local staff versus the entire scientific body of the University of Washington, which is out there working on such things?
Yeah, there's certainly
I was just going to say there's probably data already available from current flow, from soil sampling, from any sort of development that occurs.
Yeah.
Gas and fuel consumption, water consumption by residential.
So is it basically taking the data
in another
way?
We have energy bills and so forth that are fairly easy to quantify. So
maybe it's just repurposing that at some point.
So there's certainly levels of scale that you can do it in the inventory.
So one of the things you mentioned was residential and home heating. So on what Brendan touched on, if we need something measurable, if you take somebody from a fuel furnace and you convert them to electrical heat or another type of geothermal or whatever it might be, don't we have data that shows greenhouse savings just by doing something like that? And in
think since this is a voluntary incentivized program, we're just, you know, doing policies that we could use that data as a public part of the city to also impact that number.
Puget Sound Energy has extensive data on greenhouse gas emissions by sector and by residents and types of buildings and so forth.
I love the debate too, and it's probably going to be ongoing forever. It's how many millennia old people that speak the same language, right? We're talking about energy resources, who gets them, how do you deserve them? To me, it seems like our responsibility is not so much to do research, the scientific scenario where you say, well, I have an idea, let's call it a theory, now let's go prove it. That almost always ends up in proof from your theory because you've sent a bunch of focused on getting there. It seems like our role as a city, or any city, should be to make sure that there's some incentive, there's some awareness that we're interested to the folks out there really making the decisions, the individual taxpayer who lives here. We shouldn't be coming at it from, let's take this theory that we've heard about, let's prove it, and let's put regulation in it. Mm-hmm. That's screwed up. That's the way the government and the federal level works, right? So I'll just put that out there and kind of leave it floating. We can't start down this road of let's prove this something and then force it on somebody else. Because we go about it, proof of it doesn't mean it's true.
Well, the correcting information and organizing that,
sure.
I don't see that as a level of proof. I mean, and if you were coming at it from a truly scientific perspective, it's doubt. You have a hypothesis and you try to disprove it, right? So there's more doubt in science than there is in proving if you go
unless there's grant money funding to prove it.
Right. But see, the grant money in this situation is based on the idea that the international community has reached some sort of an agreement, by and large, maybe not everybody. And the fact of the matter is they're looking at those data as, yes, this is something that we need to pay attention to, just like terrorist activity rising in a certain city or a different part of the country. I mean, it's just data. You know, is somebody guilty of a crime or not? It's the same thing. So they've, by and large, accepted that, and as a result, they've set aside money to work towards these initiatives because they've accepted the science as actual fact. So I don't know how much more proving there is, other than, okay, we see this as a cause. We're going to incentivize states and cities and everybody to try to reach those goals so we can get a collective good and try to manage it.
Well,
I guess I see the flip side of that, which is...
So what are the incentives? I mean, we talked about them before in some of the other conversations. There's like the different levels of LEED stuff. There's those types of incentives, and I feel like I agree with Jim that it feels like there's a lot of time, money, and effort that would go into. Because even still, if the city is going to step up and take the stuff that, you know, bills and consumption of fuel, I mean, it's still time, effort, and money to do that. So instead, is it better that we focus on the standard things that are out there, that the incentive programs that are out there, like the Puget Sound Energy has, or whoever these other, you know, programs are that are out there for us, that we publicize those, make that information available to people, and they decide, I want to do that, I don't want to do that.
Well, the flip side is, as you're quantifying this, you can also come up with an alternative perspective that, hey, we don't need to do this, right? So collecting data can be used in either direction.
I guess I'm not trying to say that we should be saying we should or shouldn't do this. Give people... Here are all the options on the table of things that you can do, whether they're, you decide for yourself if you agree that putting in furnace A or other thing B.
To creating codes and restrictions.
Right. Here's the information. You go decide what you want to do.
I apologize. I thought we were talking about what are we doing going forward, not so much getting to that code and regulation mm-hmm. founding, other than we can comply to certain things to get grant monies. That's clear. Those are staked out there, and there are things that we can do.
I think it's difficult
right?
for us to do an inventory, and I think that's just terribly difficult for us to do.
Well, I don't know how much, you know, that's where
well,
I
that was part
to
of my question, which is what kind of an inventory.
Yeah, we can certainly do it as a municipal resources inventory, which is much smaller scale. easier to understand, easier to then set targets for reduction.
It's still time, money,
it's
and effort.
It's still time, money, and effort.
But it addresses a lot. It settles a lot of debate.
But I don't feel like we need to introduce debate. I think we need to introduce, here are the options of what people can do, as opposed to, I'm right, you're wrong, you need to do this thing. Like, I don't feel like we need to introduce debate into our policy.
I'm wrong part of it.
Well, I'm saying introduce debate. We don't need to introduce debate to say, we've got to do this because look at how bad this number is.
Public education will be a very big part of this effort. And I think one of the things that we want to do is just introduce people to the resources out there. So we're not necessarily coming up with the raw data, but we can link people to the information that's being provided by Puget Sound Energy.
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. Yeah.
And that's all I was talking about, is trying to find cost-effective instruments that we may have at our disposal, such as the fuel efficiency or fuel consumption or fleet management and these type of things. That's where I was trying to go with that. So I think we have those data available to us that can work. Either yes, we need to be more proactive, or no, we're fine.
Well, I guess going back to my fundamental question is are we talking about data points, inventory of information the city already has, and collating it in and presenting it in a different form? We already know how much fuel you buy. We already know PSE's got everybody's record. We know every geotherm that goes through any building, right? I mean, what is it that we would be trying to capture different than what we already have, or how would we be looking to present it differently than what we already can?
I think it's what the overall intent is to identify whether your policies that you've set are effective long term for making a difference.
So it really comes back to measurement.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just measurement of the baseline, but measurement over time,
right?
And then coming back and evaluating, has that been effective?
So we have a baseline?
We don't right now, no.
Which is what this is about. It says you've got to do the inventory to get your baseline.
Yeah.
Then you would have to measure periodically against it.
Mm-hmm. And so the broader question is that a valuable use of resources as a small city? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's something that we just have to, you know.
In these workshops you went through, are there other cities of this size that are doing this? You said there are half the cities in King County.
Yes,
that's a couple of cities.
So far, yeah.
And are they, what are they doing?
They have a sustainability action plan. Pretty extensive. Some of the U.S. conference made this climate action agreement. They had a sustainability action plan. They're working currently, or they have a greenhouse gas inventory, and now they're working on their reduction goals. So they're pretty far down the process.
Well, even the mayor had a contest a little while ago about garbage and waste, right?
Yeah. Gary?
Yeah, I guess I just want to be on record and say that I think if we just do it for the city, then we miss an opportunity here. And the reason why I'll be passionate is not about just greenhouse gases. It's back to the CO2 and the CO2 levels in our atmosphere. And while we're not having coal-fired plants within our borders, if we look at the residential number, I think that we could use some kind of quantitative analysis that said, if you're a homeowner and you're on this type of furnace and you want to move this, just sign up with the city, get, you know, linked in, and we can track that and use that as our reportable number for improving the residential number. So I think, along what Piper's saying, it's a voluntary thing, and what these sustainability policies are volunteer, they're not code, right? And I think it's a great opportunity if we were to extend this beyond the city to try and think about North Bend and hard to leave, because we don't have the pollution problem, and we don't have, you know, certain things that are going on that are positively impacting this. One other point, perhaps Dr. Gavin will make sure I'm correct on this. The life of CO2 in our atmosphere is about 100 years. Is that?
That's for the first 60-70% of it. Some of it is in this air for 10,000 years. The last quarter of it's there for thousands of years.
I think that explains the exponential growth, right?
Yeah.
So we wanted to move into the draft policies that we have that address specifically greenhouse gas emissions. So the first two here are just broader policies.
Oh, here.
Let me interrupt.
Well, happy to have you.
The tenant from across the street, does somebody own that white Volkswagen?
Yes, am I in your spot?
Yes.
Okay.
For future reference, the house is not vacant anymore.
It's not vacant?
No.
Okay, thank you. I did not know anybody's occupied
there. No, you're fine for now.
Okay.
You're fine for now, but...
Great. Well, I'm glad to see that somebody's taking residence there.
There's a truck park there.
Okay. I didn't...
Yeah, it's okay. Come here.
Thank you for...
Yep. Chris will come. Hey.
How you going?
Come on.
And that was a nice interlude. So why?
So the first policy is just a broad policy that talks about setting those targets for not just greenhouse gas emissions, but a number of the sustainability factors that we've been talking about. The second policy deals with public outreach and education. These are the policies then that address the inventory that we've been talking about. The way that we do have the policies in there right now is that system of establishing inventory, set targets, and monitor for reduction over time. But that's where I wanted to have that discussion. Is this the appropriate track?
My vote is on 3.1 to extend that to include a statistical model to use for residential improvements. So it's not an one-to-one analysis, but it's if you are upgrading from a gas furnace, you know, or something as an alternative energy source. I don't know that.
And I do know some utility companies that have got some great
AC dishwashers and stuff like that, and have actually done lotteries with certain citizens. I'm just in Michigan, in fact, you know, like this, where you give them all your old appliances, they hook you up with all the new energy efficiency systems and track. And those are municipalities. So in Michigan, which doesn't have our economy, and that seems to be correct. But,
so
I don't know how that has to be.
To a practical matter, so policy 3.1, how would you do that?
How would we do it? We would probably hire an intern to manage a software program that then collects all the data. You're inputting your data from your municipal sources, your energy bills, your fossil fuel, or your gas bills, etc. That then goes into a model that you can kind of project out what are our...
So that's something that's done over a couple of months?
Or to create the baseline inventory, probably so.
Sounds like a great college project for a climatology student.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that it'd be kind of using Professor's example about the difference between weather and climate. Just 2 months' weather, or is it a year climate? You know, what would that baseline need to establish? So maybe there's some more due diligence that, you know, is that 2 months enough for?
The model wouldn't be related to climate. The model is
I was just using that as if we only have a few data points, right? Is that...
My reference in time was in how long does it take to input the data.
Yeah.
The data points could be 3-5 years of data, right?
Okay.
But to input, it's going to take several months.
Is there a... this popped in my head because we just recently replaced a residential weather station that was about 15 years old. We bought it 15 years ago. It was about $3,000. The replacement, which had a lot more information, a great more detail, and more accuracy, was about $300. Is that true of something that can sniff out emissions and kind of sort the data as it goes? Does that exist?
If you want to measure CO2 in the air around your city, that's more expensive.
Well, that's what I'm getting to. What's the scenario there?
I don't know of automated greenhouse gas sampling systems. And if there are, they're more expensive. In terms of automated weather stations, I would put NASA DW to be the first person to ask.
I was hoping that you were going to tell me that they're really cheap now if you just plan them around where you want.
A little box that measures CO2 and can run by itself for a week or a month or 6 months is about $2,000.
I think it sounds like that, though, is there's too many variables. What we're looking for is a control measurement that says these are the inputs that we have control over.
Right.
How are we doing over time to the end of
this? Your emissions don't try to measure any of these.
Okay, thank you for that.
What next steps are is we want to take it back from, we've had these workshops now, we've had input from the public, from the planning commissioners, and just been thinking through some of these things. What I want to do now is go back and spend some time in the draft energy and sustainability element and work in those comments. So in August and September, we want to have planning commission review some of those amendments to make sure it's consistent with the input that you have and that the public has provided, and then bring that back for a public hearing September 13th, and then on the council after that.
Just real quick, Mike, you mentioned water conservation is one of the points, and is that going to be in this section, or was that in another section?
Water conservation was in another section, and that section primarily referenced our water system plan, just because we don't want to have policies here, policies here, policies there. Mm-hmm. So the water system plan and also conservation policies.
So you're looking at this one segment of it, and I'm even thinking of it broader than that. I mean, we've been over the last couple of months, and you said we've got a number of these workshops now. When do you think that you'd be able to get the entire draft back in front of us? Because I want to step back and read and absorb and think of the whole. You know, we started with the whole, and we've been kind of fleshing out the pieces as we go. I'm lost in the weeds at this point. I want to step back up and think about the whole body of work.
Yeah. So probably the second meeting of August is vicious, but
thank
for that.
It's probably
to be able to get us the draft by that time.
Yeah. Aggressive system.
Yeah. And then a public hearing, like.
See, if I don't, I'm feeling that I would agree with you, and so to have a public hearing a couple of weeks later,
okay.
Feels really pushing it.
Yeah, we're not limited by a deadline. Yeah.
On that note, Mike, on the basis of a schedule, I know that we don't have a large cross section of the public here, but I'd like to speak on behalf of the public in order to allow meaningful public input on the draft document.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It has to be accessible and available to the public at least 2 weeks before the hearing.
Yeah.
So
I would absolutely agree with you. Yes.
And the draft has been on the website.
But not with all the comments.
Right.
I'll be delivering a lot more very shortly.
Why don't we just assume that we're September 13th is too.
Yeah, we won't worry about that.
We'll set the public hearing date once we.
At appropriate time, we definitely want to keep it moving along, but just to the points we're making, I want us to all have time to really read the whole body of work, absorb the public comment, think it through, a larger public hearing to look at the body as a whole.
And we are time constrained that we have to have this done by October 1st or...
Right. It's going to be the only thing we work on.
I can't
this
believe
year
it.
That doesn't have a deadline.
We might have some of our deadline issues. Okay.
I don't know if it's the perfect time for this comment, but I'm just going to ask a question maybe to you, Professor. Has there been, as we go down this road of energy related CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas, global warming, have there been project structures, be it both single-family, commercial, office building. I know we've done the dance with automobiles, but has there been somebody who's put together structures that really prove that one way is better than another?
In terms of reduced emissions, I would say building codes. Yeah, state level. California is really a leader.
Well, I'm not thinking so much about the code, but the physical.
You're saying measuring the actual
test structure, the project structure that was built and is now proving out what was theorized.
I think 15 years ago, NRDC worked with EPA to weatherize some houses in the Pacific Northwest, and they measured the changes in energy. So, that's just one that I know about.
Well, I think at a building level, you've got the, it's not out there yet, but the, you know, Bullitt Foundation is taking an incredibly aggressive zero emissions.
They're super green.
And then of course they've been arguing with the city over the one that they just approved.
Oh, yes.
Nobody else can meet that standard.
Under green standard or whatever. So, that one was being a sub-green standard, but...
They eat their own poop and everything, right?
There are other communities. I could actually look into that, Jim. I know someone who was sharing with me. It's actually done for an artist community. It might have been in California or Arizona that was designed on the
canyons in Arizona, I think.
Aspect. It could have been the canyons. It was just. It was essentially in a condo building, but meant as an artist community. It was. Designed with kind of a zero emissions goal, and it's been up and running now for years, and so that's
I kind of bring it up because that's a whole conversation. Mm-hmm. I know that they exist. I'm not thinking of them now. I know we've got some Esquire Highlands that we've visited.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That to me is a real value to the citizens that we talk about those things. Those factual, real deal affect their bottom line. The reason this becomes political is because the whole conversation is so nebulous. There's no hard concrete that any one person could say, yeah, I've seen that, or at least it's very rare. Mm-hmm. But to talk about a structure, everybody can see that's a tangible, and they'll react to it. They'll pay more. They'll pay $50,000 for an electric car when they could have paid $20,000 for a gas car, because they get it sometimes. So that's the piece. I'd love to see that in this mix somehow. We talk about tangible evidence, not just the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what we were talking about in some of our earlier policies in the earlier part of the element is let's go after the biggest bang for the buck. So a green roof can cost a fortune, and maybe it looks pretty, but you're not necessarily going to get your energy savings or return on investment than if you're just installing additional insulation and if energy conservation is the path.
If you heat your home with fuel oil and you can convert to natural gas, your emissions go down by half. The same you can do with natural gas is going to be cheap for a long time.
Which, back to the consumer, it's the emissions has some nebulous, to Jim's point, it's kind of, that's hard to grasp. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Right.
Give me it in terms of dollars, and I get it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Give me it in terms of what's happening to my monthly bill.
I'm putting a solar panel on my roof this summer, and I'm not going to get it back as an investment for a long time, 10 years or more. Yeah. But I feel that's the right thing to do, and I'm setting an example of how to use this thing.
So to that point, one of the things I wanted to share tonight as we're talking about this and kind of why I'm asking about the body of work as a whole is because, I'll describe it in strata. I'm thinking about what are the things we're trying to do here in our community that are direct in the community. And to me, when we talk about potential flooding and what do we do about the levees or not about the levees, or what do we do about dredging and what are the impact, what are the things that have a practical impact immediately upon us here? That's kind of one strata. What are the things that we can do that aren't as tangible, but maybe still have an impact directly here to us in the valley? Then I wonder about our responsibility beyond our borders, and even if we could go no further than, say, the state level. And I wanted to post this, and I know, forgiving, because I know I kind of post this last week, but I want to do it with the doctor here, because he was talking about the fires in Siberia and soot coming back and the things that you described there. And my question is that here we've got a debate going on, Congress, our local congressmen, as well as the state leaders, around port improvements so that we can ship coal from Montana and Wyoming to China. And we spend a lot of time here setting policies in the state of Washington around more renewable sources and greener sources of energy, which is pushing these companies to sell coal to China. And so we spend a lot of energy shipping it overseas so it can come back to us in the form of the soot. What are we really doing? And should this community be one that is voicing to county and state and federal level, hey, what are you doing? What good does it do us if we, I guess my question to you, Doctor, is so what is the impact of all of these wonderful things that we're doing here in the U.S. to go greener in energy production if we're still using our own resources to just burn them somewhere else?
So now I take off my plebiscitist hat and put on my citizen hat.
Well, I'm really asking it now from the climate perspective. Are we really making an impact in a world level at 30,000 feet?
We're an enabler. We're facilitating the combustion of fossil fuel. We have to be, as a world, we're going in the other direction. So the leadership position would be don't help the tar sands get developed. Don't help coal being dug out of the ground and shipped to China to burn. Don't do that.
Well, or
it comes back to ourselves.
Well, or should we be applying our own cleaner technologies to burn that coal at home and not ship it to China so it comes back?
Well, again, that's just the coal for coal. Burn natural gas and you save factor two in emissions. And natural gas is just a transition from you don't have to burn it. You should leave all the fossil fuel in the ground, burn as little as possible. And cities like Bellingham, like Seattle, like Chicago, have voted as cities that they're opposed to the coal export. And any city that met such a resolution would pass it if they felt that. And PowerCast Coal is organizing meetings throughout the Northwest.
Yeah. It's a tough policy choice.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to go there.
And again, that's my personal opinion now. Not,
I understand.
Not because this is kind of funny sense.
Wasn't that long ago that some homes here in Valley burned coal?
Absolutely.
Oh, I bet not very long ago. Yep.
That's so long ago I remember seeing coal in my own house.
Yep.
Are we, I think, other comments, audience, members of the...
Will there be an opportunity to have another public session so that we can continue? I know we've had conversation, but we're not interested in the debate. However, this evening there was an opportunity to hear from an expert from that individual's perspective. Mm-hmm. There is very much so another perspective out there. You know, you may not have been aware. You obviously brought the expert in to get more information for yourselves as you're embarking and working through this policy decision-making process. My point is that there is still no information that you haven't gathered yet. And I'd like to, I know that this was supposedly planned to be the fourth and final workshop, but I also heard that there are no schedule constraints. And I'd like to submit to the commission that you consider at least entertaining another meeting here down the road, maybe the next month. And if I'm able to arrange another expert to come in that might be able to share additional information with you, would you be able to ask the question?
Yeah, well, Mike, what I'd ask is and so the information that we'd ask you to submit, I would presume that those sources would be part of what you could supply, and if you could supply Mike with those proposed people, then he can work directly to look at that. I'm certainly not opposed to, and we're going to have a public hearing in which those experts would certainly be, not only welcome, but invited to come in to testify. So
again, understood. You know, the public hearing generally limits any testimony to 3 minutes, so mm-hmm. you're a lot more constrained on the amount of information transferred in that sort of a scenario. And again, in the sense of fairness, there was 2 hours that was put out on the table.
These are working sessions, so it's a little bit different than just get up and
find it. And that's what I'm asking for, is an opportunity to have a fair and balanced working session.
Yeah, did we determine our next meeting? Did we slot that for this topic? Is it already on the calendar, or we didn't do that yet?
We talked about the second meeting in August, having the draft, and then a public hearing sometime in September.
So
well, one question. You guys normally take one meeting off in August. Are you planning to do that, or do we have a full August?
I don't think we've made a decision.
I prefer this comment because we've all been to school and all been to the media and read different things. And with all respect, it is debated still on a level that I can't comprehend between folks who know what they're talking about. So I'm all for let's bring in, if somebody else knows of another expert, let's hear it. And if we need to have time and accommodation to make that happen, I think we have that responsibility since we've started it this way.
Yeah, I support that as long as we really define what an expert is.
But, you know, but we didn't define this expert.
Yeah.
So this was not defined. So I feel like
I saw his bio and it kind of speaks for itself that, that he is an expert in the field. But if it's somebody who's doesn't have equal credentials or is
agreed.
You know, an engineer for asphalt design or something, whatever is, I wouldn't be inclined to say apples to apples comparison.
I agree.
What we can do is Larry could provide us some names of people that are scientists that have a different perspective and definitely, like you said, aren't employed by Exxon or what have you. And if we have that debate, or not necessarily a debate, just the alternative perspective, hey,
I think it should be exactly what it was tonight. It's an informational session. Yeah. They present the facts. We're allowed to ask questions. I feel like we need to set the framework today that we're not going to sit back and debate just like we did today. It's like, okay, we're not debating. We ask questions to make it even playing field so we do all get the same information from both sides. I think it makes sense. I think it's a disservice if we don't do that.
I'll also give some names to you that I have from Mike, and we can continue. I guess if you need more input, I'll give you names and let you know if you need more information.
Absolutely.
You guys need a motion from us, or can you just make it happen?
Oh, we can make it happen.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, you guys, I mean, don't feel like you have to rush through this pretty in-depth topic. You know, this, like Mike said, we're not mandated to approve. And approve anything. And the fact that we're working on it shows our interest in solving the future questions we have for making North Bend whatever our community ends up deciding with regard to sustainability.
I think because we entertained, you know, the conversation that we had tonight and with the comments of the commission, you absolutely should go that route if there's one available. I'll make the comment from the other side that I honestly found not, you know, with deference to you, Doctor, because it's great information, but I didn't really feel that I learned anything that was pertinent to what I was considering here on, right? I've seen Al Gore's movie. It looks the same. I've seen the data on both sides, as Larry shared with us. You know, I've formed my opinion on what the you know world situation is, where we are in global climate change. It's not going to do me much to get another opinion. I'm interested very much in what we're going to do here, and so I find it, you know, the information you presented, you know, very informative and very scientific and factual. It's not at a level that can translate to what we do.
Yeah, as I said, I think that in a way I was kind of mismatched to your needs. But I think that if you're considering somebody who can, a group that can address more on a regional basis within the state, the impacts of climate change and adaptive measures, then somebody from the climate impacts group would be good.
Yes. That, yes, when you mentioned that, I don't think I said that I would really like staff to look into that. Bringing it closer to home would be much more valuable. And I would also invite, you know your field and the scientists within it. There is that 3%. It'd be great, along with Larry, if you're saying, hey, you want to hear from somebody who disagrees with us who is just as eminently qualified, here's who you would get data from.
The names you mentioned, Donald Estabrook is the one that comes most to mind. He's written a book about this, and he's at the Western Lab. He would make an articulate presentation of that for me, which is wrong.
But I appreciate that, because that's the kind of, you know, but it's saying, yeah, I disagree, but he's got the qualification.
qualifications to speak to it.
What upsets me the most, in fact, was that I really, people talking for opposing opinions, in this sort of journalistic balanced point of view, this is more like, is the world round? Mm-hmm. Does the earth go around the sun? Does smoking cause cancer? We're at that level of certainty. Mm-hmm. Certainly smoking and cancer, that's where we are with climate change. So, yeah, you could get somebody from the tobacco industry who said, we still don't have any proof that there's any connection between smoking and health. Where do we get off?
For what it's worth, your presentations, wherever you give them, cause everyone to think.
Good. Well, that's
so
good.
That's the key part of all of this discussion.
The funny reaction was comment, though, too. There was a time, back in the Middle Ages, when the science of the day didn't claim that the world was flat and that it's not revolving around the earth.
Okay. You argued you were beheaded.
Do I have a motion? When have you reached a preponderance? What is it going to look like?
I mean, evidence. I don't know how you're going to debate.
I brought all of this, and I don't think anybody ate it.
Didn't touch it well. I know.
It was dinner. I'm like,
it's kind of sick. I should have taken some of it.
But now you've changed.
I was kind of shocked by the statement that you made earlier.
Which one? I'm going back to India for a month. So, our next meeting
soon, I'll be able to see your face and I'll carry over that.
Anything beyond the 17th until I get back tonight in September. So,
there's got to be some outreach that we're making.
I'll be gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you a little email.
That parcel's got you. That parcel's been used to, you know,
it's got issues.
Yeah.
I don't know the history.
But the lot doesn't have
issues. Well, the parcel's been used over the years as kind of a dropping point of unsuitables. Yeah. So John David, for example, looked into buying it to expand the housing. The amount of dirt work is going to be required to make it compact enough. It's huge amount of dirt work. So there's a couple different things we're thinking of. Number one, it's zoned industrial and it's back away.